In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." They replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days." But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at this Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person.
Thanks, Alex. So we are about 5 or 6 weeks into our sermon series in the Gospel of John. And right back at the very beginning, at the beginning of September, we had the reading from the very beginning of John, from the prologue, "In the beginning was the Word," etc. And I titled that sermon, "Is It Christmas Already?" Because it's a reading that most of us would probably most associate with carol services. Well, today I've entitled our sermon, "Is It Easter Already?" Because this is a story that we might mostly associate with Easter. It's often a reading that we'll read in Holy Week. And the reason for that is that the other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, place this story in the last few days of Jesus' life. John, however, and we don't know why, places it 2 or 3 years earlier, at the start of Jesus' ministry. Now, John often places things in a different order to the other three Gospels. Perhaps he places things thematically rather than chronologically. The truth is, we're not entirely sure. But I quite like having it set here at the start of Jesus' ministry. And I especially like it as a counterpoint to the reading that goes just before it, the beginning of this chapter, the bit that Michael spoke about last week. So in that passage, Jesus is hanging out with his friends and with his family. There's a big wedding, everyone's having a party, and he produces a whole bunch of the finest Chateau Neuf du Pape so that everyone can have some fun. It's chilled, cool, fun Jesus. And then here, straight afterwards, we've got Jesus going up to the temple, seeing the animal sellers and the money changers, and having what we can only describe as a temple tantrum. He goes ballistic at them. And it's a reminder that Jesus is a fully rounded person. He is not just gentle Jesus, meek and mild, but is so much more than that. So I quite like where it's set here. So Jesus goes up to Jerusalem, goes into the temple, he sees the people selling animals, the people changing money, and he does not like it one little bit. So much so that he makes a whip out of cords, quite menacing, and then he drives the animals out of the temple. Can you imagine the chaos as cows and sheep and goats are charging around and doves and pigeons are fluttering everywhere? And then he goes over to the tables where the money changers are, and he flips the tables over, coins flying everywhere. By the way, There's a really nice thing that apparently recently a preacher asked AI to come up with an image of Jesus flipping over the tables in the temple. The picture is not of Jesus flipping over the tables, but of Jesus doing an acrobatic backflip over the tables. It's a spectacular image and incredibly enjoyable. Anyway, Jesus didn't, to the best of our knowledge, do an acrobatic backflip over the tables, but did turn them over. So the question is, why? Why is Jesus so upset with what is going on? Because the truth is, the animal sellers and the money changers were perfectly legit. They had every right to be there. You see, this was Passover. And at Passover, people came from all over the known world to come to worship at the temple. They came not just from the Middle East, but from Africa and Europe and Asia to come and worship and to bring their sacrifices to God. Now, we don't have the sacrificial system anymore, but back in those days, if people wanted to say sorry to God, they would sacrifice an animal to do so. And as we spoke about a few weeks ago in the lamb and the dove sermon, there were different sacrifices, different animals, depending on who you were and also on what you were wanting to say sorry for. And so these people come from all over. But it's completely impractical for someone coming from Ethiopia, say, to herd their goat with them all the way to Jerusalem. So instead, what they would do is sell the goat in Ethiopia and then make their way on their pilgrimage all the way to Jerusalem, where they would buy a goat at the temple in order to then make their sacrifice. So perfectly legitimate for the animal sellers to be there. On top of that, of course, if they're coming from Ethiopia or wherever else, they will have a different currency. So they have to change their money into local currency in order to do so. So both the money changers and the animal sellers are perfectly legit. Why then is Jesus upset? I think he's upset for two reasons. The first has to do with greed. The problem was that the money changers had started charging exorbitant fees to change the pilgrims' money. And then the animal sellers had started increasing the price that they would sell their animals for. So much so that by Jesus' time, they were often charging 20 times as much as the animals were worth. And so these poor pilgrims coming to worship and to make sacrifices were ripped off not just once, but twice. Now you might say, that's capitalism. It's market forces. It's supply and demand. Jesus said it's a scam and it's greed. And we haven't got time to go into it all that much now, but there might be a whole host of practices in our world today that we call capitalism, supply and demand, and market forces that Jesus might actually call greed. Now, churches are not exactly like temples, but there's some similarities. Like a temple, people come here to worship. And just like temples are not immune to the greasy fingers of greed, just like temples aren't immune to them, churches are not immune either. And sadly, across our nation and across our globe, we can see examples of where the greasy fingers of greed have got their way into church life, where churches have found themselves more obsessed with money than they are with the goodness of God. And that's why we do the thing that Martin just did earlier. That's why twice a year we talk you through our finances, because we want to be accountable. We want to be good and faithful stewards of the money that you so faithfully give here. And we have to do that regularly. Otherwise, things can begin to slip. And that is not what we want. And so, you might have been bored out of your brain at Martin's pie charts. I'm sure you weren't. But if you were, I'm sorry, but we're still going to carry on doing it because it's so important. Because greed has a way, or the obsession with money has a way of sneaking into all areas of life, and churches are not immune to that. So that's why twice a year we will do this kind of thing. So I think the first reason that Jesus was angry was because of greed. The second reason is that actually what the animal sellers and the money changers were doing was preventing a whole group of people from being able to worship at all. To understand this, we need to have a mental image of the temple courts and precincts. So if you can imagine that the temple is on top of a hill, and then basically there are outer courts, inner courts, and then an inner sanctuary right in the middle. So as you get there, you come to the outer courts, and then as you go in, you get closer and closer to the centre. But as you do so, fewer and fewer people are allowed to go into those particular areas. It is, in essence, an incredibly hierarchical system, and an exclusionary system, and one which I'm delighted we don't have today for worshipping God. But so basically, the outer courts, the bit yet to first, well, that was also called the court of the Gentiles. And that was as far as anyone who was not born a Jew was able to go. They could go to the court of the Gentiles to worship and to pray, but they couldn't go any further. And in fact, archaeological digs have found that on the walls in between the outer courts and the inner courts were inscriptions that read things like, "For a Gentile to go beyond this point means death." So they took it really seriously. So then, if you were able to, you could go from the outer courts to the inner courts. And the outermost of the inner courts, excuse me, was the court of the women. Now, men, Jewish men and women were allowed in this court, but it was called the court of the women because that's as far as women were allowed to go. Then, within that, there was the court of Israel, and that's where Jewish men could go. And then within that was the inner sanctuary, and only priests could go there. And then right at the very center was the Holy of Holies. And only one priest, the high priest, could go there, and only once per year. And that place represented God's presence. That was God's dwelling place amongst his people. And we'll come back to that in a bit. But for now, then, the important thing to know is that for everyone who wasn't born a Jew, for everyone who was a Gentile, the only place that they could worship God was in the outer courts. And it was meant to be, as Isaiah tells us, a place of prayer and worship. But the fact that the animal sellers and the money changers had moved into the outer courts of the temple meant that there was no space for worship. And so they were prohibiting all the Gentiles from worshiping God. They'd put barriers up to stop a large percentage of the people coming from engaging in worship at all. As a very brief detour, it's worth us remembering as churches today that it's so easy for us to put barriers up to people who feel on the outside, like those Gentiles would have felt like outsiders in the temple. So easy for us to put barriers up to people who feel on the outside, up to them being able to engage in worship. And people feel on the outside for all sorts of different reasons, perhaps because of socioeconomic background or education, or gender, or sexuality, or ethnicity, or skin colour, or language, or where they're at on their faith journey. Let's be a church that doesn't put up barriers to worship, but rather tears them down. Let's be a church that is open and welcoming to all. So, Jesus was angry because of greed and because of putting up these barriers to worship. So understandably, at that point, some of the people there were like, "Hang on a minute, what are you doing? What's going on? What proof do you have that you have the authority to do this stuff?" And Jesus replies with one of his gloriously, seemingly random replies, but the more you look at it, the more brilliant you realize it is. So they say to him, effectively, "Why are you destroying our temple? What authority do you have?" And he replies by saying, "If you destroy this temple, I will raise it again in 3 days." And they haven't got a clue what he's talking about. And so they take him literally. And so they say, well, what do you mean you could rebuild this temple in 3 days? It's taken 46 years to build this temple. In fact, they barely knew the half of it. It actually took a further 30 years to complete the building of the temple. 76 years. Makes HS2 look positively on track, doesn't it? But Jesus wasn't talking about the temple. John tells us that Jesus, when talking about the temple, was referring to himself, to his body. So he was saying, if you destroy this temple, I'll rebuild it in 3 days. What he's doing is pointing forward to his death and resurrection and saying, that is the proof of the authority that I have. And that's pretty good. But it goes even deeper and gets even better. And at this point, we get to the point in the sermon, as I've said to you before, where the pretentious preacher says something like, of course, in the original Greek. So, of course, in the original Greek, there are two words which are translated into our English Bibles as temple. The first word is hieron, and that relates to the whole of the temple precincts, all the buildings and courts and porches. And that's the word that's used in verses 14 and 15 of this chapter when Jesus enters the temple and when he clears the temple. So that word relates to the whole overarching temple. But there's a second word that gets translated as temple in our Bibles, and that is the word naos. And that has a much more specific meaning. It actually relates to the inner sanctuary, to that place which holds the Holy of Holies. It's the place which is the dwelling place of God. And that's the word that Jesus uses here. So he says, destroy this temple, destroy this naos, destroy this sanctuary, this dwelling place of God, and it will be rebuilt in 3 days. So his authority is not just in the fact that he will die and be raised to life on the third day, but also that he is the dwelling place of God, that his body kind of encapsulates the presence of God. So that's pretty good, but it goes deeper and it gets even better. If we jump forward a bit in the Bible to 1 Corinthians 3:16, by the way, have you noticed how many of the best verses in the Bible are chapter 3 and verse 16? It's extraordinary. Anyway, 1 Corinthians 3:16, Paul, St. Paul, when relating back to this passage from Jesus, but speaking to his readers, therefore speaking to us, says, don't you know that you are God's temple and his spirit dwells in you? And which word for temple is he using there? It's naos. So Paul is saying, don't you realize that you are God's sanctuary? That God lives in you? It brings a whole new meaning to my body is a temple. I don't know about you, but when I hear people saying, my body is a temple, it's usually like gym rats or something, isn't it? You know, who are, my body is a temple. I only eat vegan food and I go to the gym 17 times a week. And that's really good, by the way. I endorse all of that. But actually, that's not the point. Our body is a sanctuary for God. Our body is a place where God dwells within us. I wonder whether, if we really believed that, it would change how we lived. So here's one way of thinking about it that relates to our theme today of giving. Is your body a naos or a hieron? Is your body a naos, the Holy of Holies, a sanctuary, or a hieron, a place filled with animal sellers and money changers? Is your place a naos, a place of worship to God? Or is it a neuron, a place of distractions and disruptions and barriers? When we talk about giving and generosity here, it's always in the context of discipleship. So Martin has spoken about the what and the how. And that's important. Like I said, it's important for you to know those things. And it's important that you hopefully feel inspired and excited about the things that we're doing here. I know that boilers aren't that inspiring and exciting, but the ministry that goes on here, that's really exciting stuff. And we believe God's got amazing things planned for this church and for our community here. But when it comes down to it, what we do with our money is a matter of discipleship. Generosity is just as much a part of discipleship as is reading your Bible or praying or mission and evangelism or meeting together on a Sunday. And that's why we talk about it. Jesus talks about it more than almost anything else. Why? Because it is one of, if not the biggest barrier to our engagement and relationship with God. Greed, or the love of money, has a way of sneaking into who we are and changing us bit by bit. You know, I don't expect that the animal sellers in the temple just one day thought, oh, I've been selling animals for the correct price, now I'm going to sell them for 20 times the amount. I imagine that what happened is one year, one of them thought, well, maybe I could charge just a little bit extra this year. And then next year, I'll be happy. But then next year, he thought, well, I did charge a bit extra, but, you know, I've got lots of mouths to feed. Maybe I'll just charge a little bit extra this year, and then I'll be happy. But then next year, he thought to himself, well, I've been charging a lot more, and I've got to say, I do really enjoy my lovely new property down on the Dead Sea, and so maybe I'll just charge a little bit more. And on it goes, and on it goes. And we're not immune to that either. I'm certainly not immune to that. Greed, the love of money, an obsession with money, doesn't hit us all in one go, but does it bit by bit. But then suddenly we realize that actually it's money and stuff and possessions that takes over a whole lot more of our thought life than worship and prayer and love and joy and hope and peace. Jesus says in another place, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So if we treasure, if we think more about money and possessions and stuff, then that's where our heart will end up being as well. And that's why this is a matter of discipleship. Because the more we have, we think we'll be happy, but actually what happens is the more we want. And the more we want, the more we think about having more. And the more we think about having more, the less we have space to think about God. And the only way to combat greed is through generosity. It's the only way to do it. And it will feel hard. But that's the call. That's what Jesus calls us to be people who are generous. And that applies to us whether we have hardly anything. And that doesn't, you know, so if you have hardly any money, but you give away 10p, that's worth more than someone who's a multi-billionaire and gives away a million. Because it's about how it affects us. And actually, the more we have, the harder it gets. And that's why God calls us to practice generosity, to do it as a regular thing, because it becomes a habit that helps us to grow. So, my hope is, as always when we talk about money here at St. Luke's, that there really isn't any guilt or any pressure, because that isn't the point. We don't want to strong-arm you into giving more money to St. Luke's. Like I always say, we don't want your miserable money, but we'd be delighted with your cheerful cash. We'd be delighted with your generous giving. Now, generosity doesn't just apply to what you do here. It applies to how you might give to other charities or to people in your family or friendship group who need help at a particular time. And it doesn't just apply to money, about being generous with time and with care and with kind words and all those kinds of things. Today, particularly, we're thinking about money. And so, let me leave you with this question. If your body is a temple, is it a neosh or an yeron? Is it a place of worship or a place of distractions and disruptions? And what might God be saying to you about how you engage with that? Amen.